is Friday, April the 12th in 2024. So we welcome you to the Chapter 49 podcast. My name is Larry Lannon. I am a retiree and a volunteer for Chapter 49. Chapter 49, as many of you know, represents most IRS employees in the state of Indiana. And once again, we welcome our chapter president, Duncan Giles. Welcome back, Duncan.
Thanks, Larry. It's always good to be here.
So I have to go back to start this off with one of our major subjects on our previous podcast a week ago. We were concerned about the aftermath of the solar eclipse. I enjoyed the solar eclipse. My wife Jane and I were out on our patio in the backyard of our condo, and it was an eerie but interesting experience to see everything go dark and all those lights that automatically come on when it's dark come on throughout the neighborhood for about 3 or 4 minutes. I think it was 3:06 p.m., something like that. To see everything go that dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon was an interesting experience. And a lot of the people who gathered at places like the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where they had like over 50,000 people, and other gatherings around our area and around the whole path of totality, all the way from Texas all the way up to Maine, I think really enjoyed that. You and I did talk about the fact that you had warned the management that there was a possibility of gridlock. Where I live in Fishers, everybody was braced for the worst. So after the solar eclipse happened in Fishers along the path of totality, I'm checking all of the Indiana Department of Transportation cameras they have along the interstate to my area. All the traffic was going just fine. I checked with the city. We don't have any problem. They were ready for the worst, and it didn't happen. So I guess it's always best to be prepared. But, you know, Duncan, this is one case where the experts got it wrong.
Well, here in Indianapolis, they've got it wrong. You know, there were a lot of parts of Texas, parts in the Adirondack Mountains up in the northeast area where it was extremely heavy traffic, and they did have those. For the Indy area, I'm quite glad, like you said, there was heavy traffic, but it flowed very well. I think one of the advantages that we have is that, you know, we're used to having an event in May that we invite 300,000 of our closest friends. So we know a little bit about traffic. But, yeah, I mean, and I was having discussions. Our national president, Doreen Greenwald, was with the highest levels of HCO, the Human Capital Office here, because we're very concerned about folks who couldn't be on telework. The folks who, you know, were in service centers, call sites that don't normally telework, and the folks who work in the tax. And I did not want any of those, and Doreen didn't want any of those, to get caught up in a traffic mess. I know in our area, they did not experience anything outside the norm, which I'm extremely thankful for. And I mean, there were some good discussions with that. I found out Saturday afternoon, Doreen texted me and let me know that they decided not to change anything for those folks. And like I said, I respected and understood their decision. I may not have agreed with it. Turns out they were correct. But I, you know, I don't think they made the decision lightly either. And I'm at least appreciative that they listened to us, wanted to make sure that, you know, they weighed the employees' safety alongside the fact that it was the last week of the filing season. There were already appointments on the books, things of that nature. So it was an amazing experience. I'm glad that we were in the path of totality, and I'm glad that I don't have to deal with that for quite a long time.
I doubt that I'll be around when the next one comes. So that's
I know I won't be, so I'm not dealing with it.
I'm less likely to be around than you, but either way, that's the way it looks. There was one traffic type in the area. I do remember if you lived in the area like around Lafayette, Indiana, where Purdue University is, Interstate 65 from the Indianapolis area up to Chicago, there were a lot of people in the Chicago area and that whole area of the country who did come down for the Path of Totality, yep. And there was a traffic gridlock up there for about an hour. It wasn't like a day longer or an evening long type of thing. So we were fortunate we dodged the bullet, and you're right, there were other parts of the country that did have those issues, but we're glad that we survived all that. We were ready, even though it didn't happen. So let's move on to our subjects for the day. The first one we're going to talk about, because this is April 12th, and for most of the country, the deadline to file your taxes would be April 15th. There are a few slivers of places where there are local celebrations or holidays, but for most of the country, April 15th is the deadline to get your taxes filed. And we've talked about this before. We want to talk about it one last time. The special responsibility under the law for IRS employees to be compliant with their federal taxes.
Yeah, this is, I cannot understate this, overstate it actually. It's huge. You need to file your returns. If you owe, you need to pay in full, if at all possible. Get this done by the 15th. If you can't get your return done, file an extension, which you legally can do, and pay the amount that you're best going to owe. And if you have to pay a little bit more than you think the worst case is, do that. You can always get that money back when you file your return. You just want to keep yourself in compliance. We've seen too many times where people have not filed their return on time. I was tired. I didn't think about it. I wasn't worried about it. I was getting a refund. Those could all end up being what we call 1203 violations, and that's a section of the federal code. And we do not want to have any of those for intentional either not filing or underpayment of taxes. So please, please, please make sure that you either file your return or file an extension by Monday. And if you're filing an extension and you're going to owe, pay what you owe now as much as possible. If you're not going to be able to pay the full amount, get into an installment agreement immediately and let your manager know so there's no surprises. I have people do this because if you either file late or you're going to owe, your manager's going to get told regardless. That's going to end up coming back to them. So you might as well give them the heads up, let them know. So when it does come down, yep, they've told me, they've cooperated with me, they've told me all the steps they're making, and it just makes it easier for everyone concerned if you do that. So just a general reminder to make sure that you get this done.
And I think it's important to remember that there's a little table, well, it's a little one, it's a large one, that union officials, representatives, and managers all need to know, and that's called the Table of Discipline. And the Table of Discipline expounds on, okay, if you're accused of this and you find that you did this, here's the penalty that you will pay. If you look at tax compliance, Duncan, it doesn't take very long before you're suspended and even considered for being fired. This is a serious matter.
Yeah, the penalty guide does not joke around about any of this because this was written into the law. The 1203 is the actual federal law that was passed because Congress wanted to make sure that if IRS was enforcing these laws, that they had a higher standard to do, and we do. And the vast majority of employees in the IRS do file on time, do pay what they owe if they do owe on time, or they try and have enough taken out during the year where they've gotten a refund back. We're probably more compliant and better off than darn near every other federal agency, and we probably should be. So I'm thankful about that, but I just don't want anybody out there to delay or say, oh, I'll take care of it later or something like that, because the consequences are big depending upon, you know, how many times this has happened to you before, if any, and, you know, what type of your situation is, because everybody's situation is a little different. It could go anywhere from, you know, a reprimand to a termination. You could be terminated if you didn't, you know, decided just the heck with it. I'm not going to file my return on time. I don't care. I'm going to owe. I don't care. It's going to be one of those things that can lead to a proposed termination. So we want to make sure that everybody avoids that type of situation.
I don't know if this ever happened to you, Duncan, but we both worked in the toll-free taxpayer service area for years. And I would get phone calls from people who would say, well, why you even do this job? I mean, my goodness, you work for IRS. You're not required to pay taxes. And I thought, really? People actually believe that. I said, au contraire, it is the opposite. You know, I didn't even get into a discussion, but in my mind, it's like I'm thinking, oh, if you only knew. It's just the opposite of what you're thinking. So, yes, IRS employees do not get a pass on paying their even state income taxes or other taxes. If you're found to have been a scofflaw in your state taxes, IRS will come back and start coming after you. So
they tried that on me this year, but I was finally able again. And this is, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is a good reminder that, you know, they stopped taking out state and county taxes on my withholding. And our folks have been very good about trying to go up to the finance center and say, hey, look, you know, this is stopped. We need to get this restarted. They're, quote, working on it. There is a systemic problem, so it's not just me, but I ended up having an issue. They didn't have any of my state or county withholding at the state, so I had to supply them with a W-2, so they showed that. They had lost my estimated tax payment that I had sent in, so I was finally able to get that resolved. But, you know, my awesome wife Kim and I were working on this because Kim was like, you know what? I want to make sure you've done the right things. I want to make sure you do not get in trouble. So even her as a non-employee knows how serious it is not to have filed your state return. So yes, just make sure that you're compliant.
Yes, Duncan, we've heard your Perry Mason case of the missing payment several times. And so it took what the equivalent of the taxpayer advocate of the state of Indiana to find your payment. So
yes, it did. And they did it in one day. I thought it was absolutely awesome.
Good.
Everybody else was chasing their tail, but they were able to find it.
Yeah, you know, I did this as a retiree. And also while I was in the service lent me out to Indiana and Purdue universities at different times to teach tax practitioner institutes. And we always get to see our people who are colleagues at the state of Indiana who work for the Department of Revenue. And I know there are a lot of good people working there, so they do their best and they get inundated with work. And they also have big workloads, but they are good people and I'm glad they took good care of you. Let's go back to something we've talked about before, but it's worth speaking to again. We talk about Schedule F. We hate to use that shorthand, but to once again explain it, Schedule F was a proposal late in the Trump administration to move a number of civil service jobs from the civil service into at-will employment, sort of like the IRS commissioner and chief counsel. You run the agency, so you are hired and fired at the pleasure of the president, although there is a term, technically a five-year term for the IRS commissioner. So Schedule F is at the forefront again because the proposal came late in the Trump administration. The Biden administration decided not to go through with it. But the Office of Personnel Management, the overall HR operation for all federal employment, at the urging of NTEU and a number of other organizations, issued guidance recently on Schedule F. The bottom line is it will make it more difficult for a future president, not impossible, but more difficult in a lengthy process to impose Schedule F. So, Duncan, again, it's a shorthand, and you talk about Schedule F, some people say you're talking about a farm tax return. No, if you're working at IRS, you're talking about something in the realm of federal employment where Schedule F has an entirely different meaning. So tell us, had the Schedule F proposal been enacted at some point, what would that have meant to federal employees and how many federal employees would go from the civil service into this at-will employment situation?
Yeah, that's the thing that we're really finding out. The more that National NTU digs into this, what we've seen for plans from possible future administrations is frankly very disturbing, because anybody who has anything to do with policy, anything, so they're trying to make this as broad as possible to make sure that they can fill it with loyalists as opposed to people who are trying to do the work that we're hired to do in a nonpartisan way. You know, everybody has their political opinions. That's natural. But when you come to work, we are, you know, what we look at is not the political parties who might be in power or not in power. We look at things called the Internal Revenue Manual, the IRMs, the statutes, things of that nature. That's what guide folks here at the IRS, and they should, and so we can do our jobs in a nonpartisan manner. What Schedule F would do is come down and, depending upon how it's defined, would be quite a few sweeping changes where they would basically take out a lot of career employees and put them in an at-will status where if they didn't bend to the political winds, so to speak, they could be terminated. And it's just, that's not how civil service was set up to be. That's not the right thing to do. And again, I've compared this to, you know, Tammany Hall back to New York in the 1850s, where it was a political patronage system, like, and you've alluded to, the state of Indiana used to have. And, you know, that is so inefficient and wrong, because we're supposed to be doing the job according to the laws and federal regulations, period, end of story. And it shouldn't be beholden to whoever holds a particular political office.
You know, this brings to my memory a congressional hearing that was done several years ago. And there were some allegations about some political interference at the exempt organization operation down in Cincinnati, Ohio area. And the Congress brought in a group of rank-and-file employees to talk about this. And what they found, once these employees testified, everybody on the committee, no matter what their political party or you know, ideology might be, commended those employees when they testified. They said, they told Congress, look, we have our political opinions. We check them at the door when we walk in to do our work. Our work is to follow the law. Now, we have to get opinions from attorneys, and that was the allegation that somehow the IRS office in Washington, the chief counsel office, was somehow putting pressure on and said, no, we were asking them for this guidance. We needed the legal direction to make the decisions that are consistent with the law. So I think it's important to remember that when you have these sensitive issues going on, and yes, people are entitled to have their political opinions, as you have said, but I can say for myself, for others, that we check our political opinions at the door when we walk in to be civil servants. We are there to do a job to take care of the law, and whether we agree or disagree with some of the policies, it is our job to carry them out. And my experience, and I think it's been yours, that's what I always did, and that's what all my colleagues always did. They had very specific opinions about things, and they weren't afraid to tell you in the break room or at lunch. But, you know, they made it clear, you know, okay, I'm here to make a decision, for instance, on the tax law. We're going to do it based on what I understand the law to be, not what my political opinion might be.
And you are so exactly right, and thanks for the flashback to the those days of the hearings where we were being grilled for something that was no fault of any frontline employee whatsoever. Basically, like you said, just doing our jobs and asking for guidance. You know, that's the thing that I've talked to congressional staff before, and they've said, well, you know, why do you do this or why do you do that? And I just look at them and said, we just implement the laws. You guys pass them. Your boss has passed law. We just implement what you pass. And a lot of times we need guidance on those, and that comes from our chief counsel. If we have subject matter experts that have been close to the law, they can, you know, help with that type of thing as well. But yeah, all IRS does is implement the laws as they are passed by Congress. And if you don't like the way that we're implementing these laws, please give us further guidance in the law, change what you need to change, and we'll follow that as well. So I think your point is very well taken.
let's move on to another issue, and that has to do with hoteling. Once again, we're not talking about staying in a hotel. We're talking about how you are required to share desks in an office when you're working telework. I would like you to update us on this. I know you've dealt with hoteling issues. You've been pretty vocal about how you think it should be done, and maybe it's not being done correctly all the time, but it is a negotiable issue, and you do talk to management quite often about these hoteling rules and how they're being handled in local offices. There is a grievance going on in another part of the country. Explain why that's an issue there and maybe not here.
Yeah, there has been now a national grievance raised out of Chapter 92, which is in San Diego, California. My good friend Dulce Hernandez was not able to get management to file the contract. They weren't letting her know what was going on with the hoteling situation, how this was going to be done, things of that nature. And, you know, it's written into the agreement. You know, we have the right to sit there and talk about this, the impact and implementation of how things are going to work. That's very basic. It's not a, you know, this isn't a far out concept, anything of that nature. And when certain parts of our facilities, our FMSS folks, don't want to have those discussions willingly, then it ends up being a grievance. In this case, because other chapters scattered across the country are having this type of issue as well, they've made it a national grievance to make sure that, you know, facilities, FMSS is on notice to be able to do the right thing. Now, we've had, in Chapter 49, we've had very, very, very good luck in dealing with facilities over the last 20 years or so. I've had good working relationships with just about everybody involved in that. And I've been able to do a lot of handshake deals. You know, okay, here's our understanding. Here's what's going on. This is what we want to do. This is what we need to do. Okay, let's get this done. What about this? How are we doing this? How are we doing this? And it comes to a clear understanding, and we're able to get things done without a formal negotiation process, which makes it easier on everybody. I'm not opposed to a formal negotiation process if that's what's needed, but up to now, for the last several years, we haven't had to have that. But clearly, this is not the same thing that's happening across the rest of the country. We have a very open and honest discussion with the facilities folks. You know, oftentimes, I'll know as much as their management chain about what's going on in a particular post of duty in Indiana, what the situation of the lease is, things of that nature. When it comes to hoteling, this is going to be the wave of the future, especially when we've been in rent reduction for the last couple of years. That's been the key thing that they've been looking to do. We need to reduce rent. We need to reduce space so we can be more economical. Now we're at the hiring boom phase with the money that we've gotten from the IRA. So that we've tried to get more employees in different locations. Well, sometimes there aren't enough desks in a particular location. We had to have a meeting in a post of duty up in our northwest part of our state with FMSS because I needed to eyeball it, and I wanted them to eyeball it because they were coming up with these numbers and they weren't jiving with what we were hearing from our steward and treasurer, Zoe Olgi, up in that area. And so we have this, we had the meeting, in-person meeting. We walked around the post of duty. They understood where the issues and problems were with the hoteling, how we needed to change it. And then we sat down and said, okay, what are we making this desk? And I mean, we literally went individual desk by desk to make sure that this was done properly. And to me, if you have these open and honest discussions up front, if FMSS would do this with every chapter, it would make it a lot easier on everybody, and we'd be able to resolve these types of issues. When we can't, that's when we get the things like the national grievance that they're dealing with now.
Well, I think in your situation, you really have to have some kind of trust between you and these officials. You obviously know each other, have dealt with each other before, and when you shake that hand, you know, you've got to trust that the FMSS people are going to do what they say they're going to do, and they have to trust you that you're going to follow through on what you say you're going to do. And so I'm saying, what I think you've always tried to work that way, if that can be done to settle these issues. Right. However, it sounds like that's not true in many other parts of the country.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. It's you know, right now we're going through a transition where we were managed out of, you know, one part of the Midwest, and now we're being managed out of another part of Midwest. You know, and I'm watching the situation very closely because I don't know that manager that well. Have I seen anything that causes me yet to have any issues or problems or anything like that? No, I don't. But, you know, I'm wary. I'm, you know, constantly wary until I know someone, until I know I can trust them. If we need to file a request to negotiate, I'll drop that off in a second. If we need to file something because of the fact that they're not following a particular part of the agreement that they should be, that'll be filed immediately. But I prefer to work in an informal setting whenever possible so we can get things done. That's what I'm always trying to do. Employees have needs. Management has wants. The vast majority of the time, you can meet that in the middle, and that's what I'm always going for.
Let me move to something else, because, Duncan, you and I remember this. You know, when I first came to work at IRS, we were a district, the Indiana district. And then Charles Rosati came up with this idea to completely overhaul how the IRS was done, to align us more like a financial services company with different stovepipes. There were four main stovepipes. There were some smaller ones and, underneath that. But one of the big ones was wage and investment. Wage and investment was the service centers or campuses, whatever you want to call them, where the processing is done. And there's also toll-free calls coming in there. There are remote toll-free sites like the one we have in Indianapolis and elsewhere in the country. So, you know, we had wage and investment. Actually, some of the toll-free sites were in SBSE, which was the small business self-employed area. Then it moved to, all of them moved to W&I later on. The reason I say all that, I remember this, Duncan. Do you remember when we had the, it was kind of like going to a funeral service. They had a celebration for the end of the Indiana district, and all the, they had pictures and slideshows. It's like, you know, RIP Indiana district was kind of like, we're going into a whole new era, which we did. And we're still, I think, not quite sure what we're doing in some of these areas. But now W&I, wage and investment, after all these years, that goes back to what, late 1990s, I think, 99, something like that. You would probably remember the exact date or year. But I do remember that W&I was one of the four big ones. And now, all of a sudden, we're changing the name of wage and investment. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's come up, you know, we're trying to make ourselves a little bit better, a little bit easier for the taxpayers themselves. So they are changing the name of W&I to Taxpayer Services, you know, because we are changing and adapting. Just it was a flashback when you said, you know, the celebration about the end of districts. Our last district director was a guy named Jim Clifford. Now, for folks in Indiana way back when, they were in the federal, the district director and their counterparts, their folks that worked under them, were up in what we used to call Mahogany Row. I mean, these were a very nice suite of offices that lined up there, and the district director had a huge office, things of that nature. Well, by the time we got the last district director, a guy named Jim Clifford, who's been high up in W&I for many, many years, he was down in a basically a cubicle, a floor below, because they started to redo all this. And he looked at me and he goes, so I'm district director and I'm stuck in here. And I said, welcome to being in the end. And it's sort of like the Fuhrer's bunker. This is it, pal. This is all you get. So it is funny that it goes from, you know, W&I Accounts Management used to be known as Taxpayer Service. And now the entirety of W&I is going to be known as Taxpayer Services. And we also want to make sure that a point that came up, I heard earlier in the week, the Taxpayer Advocate Service is saying we don't want that to be confusing with the taxpayer services. And I'm like, I can see that, and I'm sure there's going to be differentiation in messaging on this. We'll work on trying to make sure that that does happen. But it's all because of the fact the IRS is changing. It's moving around. It's trying to get better aligned to serve the taxpayer, which is the bottom line is what we should do. We're all here to serve the taxpayers, to make sure that everything is done correctly. The taxpayers get the information they need. They pay the taxes that they need. They get the help that they need. That's what we're here for. And so the service is slowly realigning to try and do that. And the switch from W&I to taxpayer services is a part of that.
Okay, Duncan, time for your final comment.
My final comment today is just the fact that, we went through this eclipse earlier this week. For those of you who've never experienced it, it really was quite interesting. It brought a lot of people together. There were people that came out from neighborhoods that I saw. There were large crowds that gathered to watch this, just as a sense of community. And anything I think that brings a sense of community, whether it's at work, whether it's at home, whatever it is, I think is a good thing. So, the more that we can have a sense of community with folks around us, be it, like I said, at work or at home, I think the better off that we are as a whole.
I don't know what it was like in your neighborhood, but where I live, I felt like it was the 4th of July when that when that happened, when we had the total eclipse happen. Fireworks went off all over the place. Did you have the same experience?
Absolutely.
So it was a celebration. My final comment has to go back to 1983. When I began at IRS, I was a supply clerk. I started at the bottom, grade 3, and moved up from there, taking, accounting classes at night. But I do remember one of the things that I took advantage of very early, once I kind of got up to speed on my job, we had something called Flexi Time, which had only been around for a short time at that point. So I was able to work 4 days a week, 10 hours a day. Now, I'd worked in the broadcasting business before I worked at IRS. I was used to working very long days. Working a 10-hour day didn't seem to bother me. And I got a day off, which I usually took Fridays off. And really, it was my manager loved it because I was the first one in. I could take care of a lot of things that were going on before he got there. That was true when I went to work what was then called the examination division. I was a clerk there dealing with some of the files, managing those. I would come in the morning and have reports on the manager's desk that they would have trouble running during the day. It was really something the managers liked, the fact that I was there. I remember one of my coworkers called me at 6:15 in the morning, because I would get to work at 6, and said, I just called you to see if you're really there at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I assured her, I'm here. Don't worry. I don't cheat on my time sheet. So, but one thing that the reason I mentioned that is there is a new trend that is lurking in the background. It isn't widespread by any means in the private sector, but it is something that is being discussed quite widely in that private sector employment area. That is going to that 4-day, 40-hour work week for people who choose to do that. There was a survey done by the Gallup organization that said 77% of all U.S. workers that were polled favor a 4-day, 40-hour week. They say it would be a positive for them and their well-being, and just would be good for them overall. And 46% of those people polled said it would have an extremely positive effect on their life and their work life and their personal life as well. So there have been some employers in the U.S., private employers, who have experimented with this. It's not widespread. IRS has had this for a while. Now, not every employee could use it that way, but as many as can be done, and NTU's worked very hard on this to make this available to people as much as it can be done. For instance, in the toll-free, people answer the phones. You can't just choose your four-day week. You can get that, but it's much more complicated to get that done where it can be done. So, Duncan, I think this is a good trend in Europe and the United States, and it's more common in Europe. In fact, in Europe, people are going to a four-day week and actually reducing that 40-hour week requirement. So, and they're finding out that employees are more productive, and it's been good for society in general. So that's something to keep an eye on. And I think it's good to say that NTEU and the IRS have been on the ground floor of this whole trend. So that's my final comment. Duncan, thank you very much once again for joining us on the Chapter 49 podcast. We're here. We try to be here every week. We don't make it every week, but we do the best we can to be as weekly as we can be. We thank you for watching and taking some time out of your time watching and or listening to our Chapter 49 podcast. We have the audio and video version out there available for you. In the meantime, we wish you well. Please be safe. And be kind.